Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with novelist Brian Washington, author of Memorial. It is such a pleasure to welcome Brian Washington back to The Reading Life. Brian is a graduate of the University of New Orleans Creative Writing Workshop and is now the George Guyon Williams Writer-in-Residence and Scholar-in-Residence for Racial Justice at Rice University. Brian made a fierce debut with his short story collection, Lot, last year, winning the International Dylan Thomas Prize, a Lambda Literary Award. He was a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 recipient, as well as one of the New York Public Library's Young Lions, and a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle John Leonard Prize. Now he's back with his first novel. Both these books are set in Houston, where Brian grew up, and he is mapping out his fictional territory, charting the lives of young gay men in a complicated, diverse urban environment. Brian Washington, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
I love this book. It is so much about the way we live now. And it began life as a short story that you just couldn't quit thinking about or working on. So talk a little bit about that evolution from short story to novel.
Yeah, when I began that short story, I had a bit of an inkling that its concerns or preoccupations that might hold me over. But I was in the middle of working on another project that wasn't going as well as I wanted it to. And in the midst of trying to write that, I would talk to friends about this other story, and they would encourage me to turn to that. And I just kind of didn't, because it takes me a little while longer to do things than some people. But I showed my agent that story, and she was so receptive and so generous and so kind. And my editor was also really receptive, generous, and kind, and they gave me the boost in a lot of ways to really throw myself expanding it and seeing where it could go.
Talk about Benson, the African-American man who works in a daycare center.
So Ben lives in the Third Ward with his boyfriend, Mike, and he works at an aftercare center. He is negotiating the sort of question between who he thinks he should be and who he is within the context of his current relationship, within the context of his family, and within the context of just the experiences that he's had. And much of the novel sort of charts his particular arc, his journey of coming into himself and realizing what he wants and seeing if he can actually get it.
And then Mike is Japanese and cooks in various restaurants, including Tex-Mex restaurants. These two guys have been together for several years, and they're coming to a kind of crossroads.
They're coming to a sort of crease in their relationship, right? And it's a tricky thing to try and put on the page, because what was really important to me for the book was to put each character in a position to where they had room for growth, and they were coming to one another from a position of love. And between Benson and Mike, I didn't want there to be an antagonist, right? In a lot of ways, I didn't want there to be like an antagonistic force. Even I didn't want someone to walk away from the book saying, okay, well, you know, the relationship worked or didn't, and this person was the reason why, because both of their standpoints are valid and both of their experiences are valid. And I wanted to put them in a position so that they would have room to grow toward one another, to connect with one another, and the choice would ultimately not be if they could or not, but if it was right for them not to, and what that looked like or did.
But also, you bring to this the balance of of long-term love. You know, you show that they've been together long enough, that they know the details of their lives together, that they know the little things about each other, the little telltale moments and expressions. And so you manage to show that long-term knowledge as well, which I think is a real gift.
I think that what was really important to me was to show how, you know, this very singular relationship and this very specific relationship, whilst they may have had trouble connecting, and while they may not have been hitting on cylinders, when we meet them and when we find them, that doesn't take away from what they have and what they've had and what they could have so much as, you know, opening up the possibility for it to change forms in the same way that so many relationships that we just have in life, we experience them one way, and then time passes, or we find ourselves in a new context, or we find ourselves introduced to new folks, and the prior relationship doesn't disappear because it was something that happened. It changed us, and it changed the folks that we were in the relationship with, but it simply changed form. So trying to look at the different ways that their relationship changes forms and what those forms could look like was really important to me.
And then family intervenes, as family so often does.
Yeah, for better or worse.
I mean, yeah, and with humor and a tragedy, all those things. And so Mike learns that his father, back in Osaka, Japan, is dying, and he goes home to see him just as his mother, Mitsuko, is arriving in Houston for a visit. So Ben and Mitsuko become unlikely roommates.
The scenario itself is a bit of a madcap scenario in a lot of ways, right? Like, a character's partner's mother arrives to stay with them just as that partner is leaving town to check up on an largely estranged father. And it's a bit of a bait and switch, and that is certainly like a central narrative, but it opened up the story for me to talk about these questions of home and these questions of connecting and these questions of what constitutes a family and whether a family is solely made up of blood relatives of kin or if a community can be a family or if a partner can be a family or if a series of friends can be a family or even folks in that liminal space between being a friend and being a significant other mm-hmm. can be a family and how it can change.
And how a friend's mother-in-law can become a family.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's just...
Right, and how that, you know, and what that can look like. You know, like an interesting thing about Reni Mitsuko's character is that while her and Benson certainly have their difficulties connecting from the outset, and in a lot of ways while Mike and Mitsuko, like his mother, certainly have difficulties connecting over the course of the text, she's the character who is the foundation of the novel in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. She's the character who is constantly looking to comfort those around her, right? Like, even from the outset, like, she lands in Houston, her son leaves immediately, and all of a sudden she's staying with a young man who is essentially a stranger and couldn't be less familiar. And yet the first thing that she does is she cooks him
yes.
a meal, right, to establish a sense of familiarity, a sense of comfort, and a sense of home. So really playing with the different forms that home can take and who can provide a home, or if a person can provide a home, or if it's simply a feeling that you can have and one that can leave or one that can linger for some time was really interesting and important to me.
Welcome back. I'm here with novelist Brian Washington, whose new book is Memorial. Well, I wonder if you'd read that little section where Mitsuko cooks for Ben.
Yeah.
And how charming it is.
Mitsuko buys 9 cookbooks from I don't know where. She says we're going to start with the classics, She's been brighter since she heard from her son, a little like Mike's given her a charge. And that night, Miko cooks what she tells me is his favorite, potato koroke. Crowded beside onions and gravy, surrounded by sliced tomatoes and lettuce. She mashes the potatoes with pork through her fingers, drizzling the mixture with salt and pepper, molding tiny patties and flipping them in flour and egg yolks and panko. I watch them crisp from the counter, and Mitsuko watches me watch them. It is the most personal thing she's shared with me so far, and I tell her that. She looks at me for a while, then says, "Don't be stupid."
She is fierce. She is so fierce in her own inimitable way.
Yeah, exactly. And like, in a lot of ways, like, I've felt as if though she were the moral center of the novel, right, around which each of the characters gravitated in their various revolutions. Because while it is a love story between Ben and Mike, as far as page time and like linear time are concerned, like, they're not really in the same place at the same time for very much of the novel.
Yeah.
And yet Mitsuko, Mike's mother, is constantly there with Benson, with Mike in the present and the past, with both of them in the future. And they learn so much from her, even if they maybe don't have the language to articulate it as such. And she changes them. So really playing with this question of how the folks in our lives, even if they're only there for a season, a handful of months or so, can change us for an incalculable amount of time going forward was really important to me.
Well, I have to say, when she's coming into the home stretch and orders that fourth margarita, you sort of root for her.
Exactly. You know, like, she's worth it. Like, she's got to deal with, like, she's worth it.
Drink up.
I mean, why not?
So if this is a tale of two families, it's also a tale of two cities. Houston, of course, where you grew up, where Benson grew up and is dealing with his own complicated family who's trying to accept his homosexuality and trying to deal with their own problems of divorce and alcoholism. And then Osaka, which is, you know, a city that has been very important, which is dear to your heart. So I want you to talk a little bit about the experience of that Japanese city and how that shaped you, and it's such an important part in the writing of this book.
I've been, and it seems a bit absurd in, like, pandemic times, but I've been really fortunate to visit Osaka for, you know, the past 5 years or so, like, once or twice a year, and not from an academic standpoint, not from a professional standpoint. When I was visiting, I wasn't looking to, like, monetize it or, like, write about it even. I was going to visit friends. And from the very first time that I spent summer in the city, the reception from friends and strangers, and, you know, strangers turned friends, was so warm and so generous that it really just felt remarkable, you know? And it is remarkable, I think, in a lot of ways, whenever anyone shows you generosity when they don't have to. And I was privy and privileged to have nothing but that. So what was really important to me for Memorial was trying to imbue the novel with at least a fraction of that warmth and generosity that I've been, you know, so lucky to have experienced. And while the city in the novel is a very specific iteration of the city and a very particular iteration of the city, because I don't know that whether you're writing about a city that you grew up in and that you came up in, or a city that you visited once or twice, you'll ever get it right, because the city is so specific to you and your experience within it and the context in which you approached it, and your experience is going to be just as valid as your neighbors and their neighbors and their neighbors and so on. But really trying to get at that warmth was something that I wanted to strive to do for this book.
Well, just the precision of the geography, you know, when Mike arrives, how he gets to his father from the airport. I mean, that's a very detailed description, you know.
Yeah, it was important to me.
I could tell.
You know, yeah. You know, you want to get the details right, and if you get those details right, then, you know, you can sort of hope get at the feel. healing itself and trying to do right by the folks who have extended me that generosity and have extended that kindness by doing your research and being deeply intentional and strategic about how, you know, you put a place on the page, whether you're from there or not, if you hold it dear, it's something that I think is really important.
Yeah. And then Mike gets to the bar and finds that his father has this surrogate family in the bar. It made me think of that show, Midnight Diner. Have you ever seen that?
I love that show.
That sweet feeling of the family of a bar where you come to eat and drink and the bartender knows you and knows what you want and knows enough about your life to ask after it.
And in this way, a sort of family is created, right? Like, not necessarily by conventional metrics, but what's really interesting to me is this question of what is the use of conventional metrics when the sort of unconventional standards that you're using are filling that void and filling that need and the various forms that it might have. I mean, interestingly enough, I have been saying this like all over the place, so it's interesting that I get to say it now. But Osaka, like in a lot of ways, it reminds me like of New Orleans, right? Like, like analogous cities to one another because they're so distinctly themselves, you know? And the residents have such pride in their city, and yet they're deeply warm and they're deeply thoughtful, and it's such a funny city, right? Like, there's just a sort of ambiance that I've experienced there, that I've been really lucky to experience there, that I've really only felt comparable just like rhythmically to New Orleans. Like, it's like the most interesting thing, and I've been trying to figure it out since the first time I went there.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with novelist Brian Washington, whose new book is Memorial. We'll be right back. The great themes of family, because there are so many families reshaped by divorce, multiracial family, families of origin and choice, work families. This is also so much about food, with all that that implies: nourishment, care, sharing, craft, adventure. And you've written so much about food in your essays, and yet it's so important in this novel, and it's woven in so effortlessly.
That's very kind of you. I think that in a novel that is largely filled with silences and largely filled with the sort of spaces in between characters trying to connect and being able to or not being able to, what I wanted to play with is this idea of how those silences are filled and how those gaps are filled in connection. And food and cooking for one another is one way to fill that void on the page. So Benson and Mike and Mitsuko all have different relationships to food, and yet they use it to comfort those around them, to make them feel more at peace and a bit more settled, in the same way that you can argue with someone, right? Like, you can say all sorts of things, right? You can reconciliate over a thing or not, and yet if you're feeding them and you're nourishing them and you're sitting down at a table with them, that is a valid, tangible feeling, right? Like, you can't disdain someone too deeply and then turn around and cook a meal for them, let alone share one with them.
Well, there's that wonderful scene where Mitsuko is breaking an egg in her palm with one hand, and Ben watches her and is kind of lost in admiration, for the pure beauty. I can't do that. I bet you can.
Let me not say on the radio unless somebody like asked me to do it. But I think, yeah, this idea of the alchemy of creating comfort and creating pleasure for someone else is something that I think mystifies Benson at the novel's outset. Mm-hmm. And while it doesn't necessarily mystify Mike, I think that what interests him and sort of piques him attention, and what changes him in a lot of ways, is the way in which you can cook and comfort someone right? Whereas Francisco, like, she's just doing it, you know, like, constantly, right? Like, aiding folks, like, making them feel better, sort of creating a home out of the meal that they share, which feels especially important in a novel where every character is sort of looking for a permanent home or a place to call home.
Yes.
And if they can't find it, that's one thing, but they're able to find it in these sort of meals that they share with one another.
Now, it's interesting to me that for a non-cookbook author, you gave an online cooking class to promote this book. So what did you make?
So we made a okonomiyaki, which is a cabbage pancake, like a savory cabbage pancake. It's really, really delicious, really easy to make. And it was really fun to do. So I was fortunate that my team and, you know, the folks that helped put everything together were down to do it.
And if readers go to YouTube, they can find you making the bread pudding you made the day you came out to your family. That's comfort food indeed.
Really is, yeah. But I've had some of, like, the best bread pudding in my life in New Orleans.
I was about to say.
Yeah. Like, of all the cities, you know, like I'll have it down.
You know, if anybody's going to ask you about bread pudding, it's going to be me.
With good reason.
Now, I'm curious, after this great response to Lot, I mean, did you feel pressure with this book? I mean, if you end up on President Obama's favorite books, you get an automatic lift, you know?
I don't know that I felt much pressure, because part of the reason is that I feel like any time that someone gives a narrative or a story that you're working on their attention, let alone likes it or lifts it up, it's, like, really strange, you know? And it's really remarkable, whether, you know, it's one person for me or whether it's many people. So it's like a sort of state of, like, thinking it's just very surreal, you know, regardless of, like, the extent of the reception. But the other reason that I think it's been not too difficult to keep much of an even keel is that I'm mostly just trying, or I suppose solely just trying to do the best job of telling whatever story I'm trying to tell at any given point in time.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, I'm writing the book that I think my friends would enjoy. Right? The one that I think would make us laugh, make them sad, but the one they might turn to and say that they, you know, enjoyed spending time with it. But even beyond that, I'm almost certainly trying to write the book that I would enjoy and that I would like to read and that I would like to sort of see, whether or not it is seen by a handful of people or many more people. So with those goals on my end in mind, it makes it not so loud, so to speak, a lot of the various things.
Well, you know, it made me think, you know how they call the novel the bright book of life? And this is the bright book of life. I mean, of every part of it, which is so wonderful. So I don't know, I'm haunted by it. I'm never going to forget these three. They are amazing people. We've been talking with Brian Washington, whose wonderful new novel, his first, is Memorial. Don't miss it. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This Is Your Time by Ruby Bridges is a pretty little book. It practically invites you to hold it in your hands. And what's inside is a story you should take to heart. The story of a 6-year-old girl marching up the steps of William France Elementary School on November 14, 1960. She was excited for a new school year, even if she was escorted by federal marshals, even if she was running a gauntlet of ugly white faces shouting terrible things at her. But Ruby Bridges persisted, school books and ruler in hand, and getting an education, making a best friend of her teacher, Barbara Henry, and becoming a leading civil rights activist. This story is addressed to the young peacemakers of America from a woman who has seen her share of race war and is determined to bring it to an end. Inspired by young people she's met in her travels, Ruby recalls meeting a student named Vay, who said, "We are all like a bag of M&Ms, different on the outside, but the same inside. Gotta love those M&Ms." Gotta love Ruby Bridges, too. Do your part to share the history she made right here in New Orleans. This is a story to share with your family, especially now. What's on tap in the literary life this week? The Poetry Buffet presents Peter Cooley, Nicole Cooley, Malaika Favorite, and Cheryl St. Germain in a virtual reading, Saturday, December 5th at 2 p.m. Check out the Facebook page for information. TikTok personality Charli D'Amelio discusses her book, Essential Charli, The Ultimate Guide to Keeping It Real, in an online event Saturday, December 5th at 5 p.m. For tickets, go to GardenDistrictBookshop.com. Support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, and the Hillis Foundation. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.